You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Everyone these days could use a little support, and your friends at the ESO Network are no different. With the ESO Network Patreon, the cool thing is when you help support us, it's you who will benefit. With four tiers starting for as little as 25 cents a week, you can listen to some of your favorite network podcasts early, hear exclusive content, maybe get some ESO swag, or even possibly take a shot at the geek seat. All you need to do is sign up at patreon.com/ESO Network.
Hey, everybody, welcome to this week's episode of Monster Attack, the podcast dedicated to old monster movies. And we're going to take a trip down sci-fi lane and another one of my personal experiences associated with, I think, a classic science fiction from 1972. This film influenced one of the most popular science fiction films of all time. And that was Star Wars. George Lucas received some inspiration from the film that we're going to be talking about this week, and that is 1972's Silent Running, starring Bruce Dern, a guy that I think was absolutely perfect to play this character. And we're going to tell you more and more about what this film is about in a second, but I want to relay to you, a little bit about what was going on at the time this film was released. It was released here. It was released in March of 1972, and that's when I saw it with a bunch of my friends. But it was under somewhat unusual circumstances because I didn't know anything about the movie when I went to see it. And I didn't go to see this particular movie at the time I did get to see it. I know that sounds a little crazy, so let me set the table for you on how things were in 1972. I was a senior in high school, and as I've mentioned on a couple of other episodes this season, when I moved to Raleigh, North Carolina, and I was living at Raleigh at this time, I didn't meet a whole lot of monster kids like I was up in Auburn, New York, where I grew up. I did find a group of people who were heavily into science fiction, so I hung really tight with them, but I was the only true monster kid as far as I was into the monsters as much as I was into science fiction. Because as we've said many, many times on the show, when we were growing up, monster movies included science fiction and all things fantastical. So the sci-fi kids, I gravitated to because at least it was something. But they weren't into the model making and stuff like I was. Not at the monster model making and things. But we went and saw a lot of sci-fi films together. Now, during this time, the studios were doing some experimenting because of the success of Easy Rider, which has gone down as probably one of the most incredible independent films ever made. Easy Rider was made for virtually no money at all and just returned millions. It's still returning money for the makers of the movie, 50, almost 60 years later. And so Universal Studios was one of the studios that got thinking, hey, with Easy Rider doing what they did, maybe we ought to invest a little bit in some of these young, up-and-coming directors, give them a little bit of money, give them, total carte blanche on how they want to make a movie and see what they come up with. And so they decided to make a couple of films under those circumstances. And there were five films they decided to finance for $1 million, give or take. This film, Silent Running, was shot for $1.1 million, which was still, a pretty good bit of money back then, but still considered low budget by the big studios. And they made five films. Those five films were The Hired Hand, The Last Movie, Taking Off, and American Graffiti. Well, of course, everyone's heard of American Graffiti. That's become a cult classic. And Silent Running was the fifth film that they financed. So this film was among that great experiment. And the director that they decided to pick to direct this film, this big sci-fi film, was Douglas Trumbull. Now, Douglas Trumbull had made a name for himself doing visual effects and special effects, most specifically for 2001: A Space Odyssey, but he did other films as well and had developed quite a reputation as being pretty good at what he did. Now, Douglas was one who admitted that when he got tabbed to do Silent Running, he learned how to direct on the fly. He learned on the job because he had really, he said, no training as to how to direct a motion picture when Universal said, hey, we want you to direct this science fiction for us. But he was really intrigued with being able to take what he had learned on 2001, special effects-wise, and bringing that to Silent Running. Now, some friends of mine had heard about this and heard that, you know, this was Trumbull's first film and, you know, the guy that did 2001, so the special effects are going to be pretty good. And this was the only publicity we heard about this movie. And that's what makes this sort of interesting, because Universal experimented in another way. They spent no money on marketing. They felt that maybe word of mouth would be enough to launch these five films. And it did, and they did it with all of these films. Now, I saw Taking Off in a small multiplex theater. It was one night. I think it was like a Wednesday night or a Thursday night. You know, like I've shared to you many times before. You know, this was back when movies weren't expensive to go see at all. And if I had all my homework done and I was all caught up in my studies, you know, my mom was real good about the fact that if I wanted to go see a movie, you know, I'd go see a movie. As long as I got back home by about 10 o'clock, she was fine with it. And Taking Off was one of those movies. And others like T.R. Baskin, and some other classic cult films that came out during that time. And great independent films that came out during this time period. Silent Running sort of falls into that category. It was released on a double bill with The Andromeda Strain. And that's the movie I was going to see the night that all the guys got together. You know, now and then, you know, a good sci-fi would come out. And we'd all get together, and Andromeda Strain got a huge buildup. And, of course, you know, a lot of us had read the Crichton book, so we were very excited about the fact that they were making a movie about this because the book was just great. And so we all wanted to go see the Andromeda Strain. We did not realize it was going to be a double feature until we got to the theater. Now, we were fortunate that we went to an early showing, so that, you know, the two of them running together ran about 3.5 hours long. This is an hour and a half long movie. And, of course, Andromeda Strain was a little more than 2 hours. So when we got there, the guy says, hey, you want to see this Silent Running? We've heard about that. That's the one that Douglas Trumbull is going to direct. You know, the guy from 2001, A Space Odyssey. Why don't we stay and watch that? That might be pretty good. And, of course, I was into science fiction, too. And I was like, yeah, why not? You know, what do we got to lose? You know, they're throwing it in. I mean, this was back when they released a double feature back then, a lot of times, you know, you got it for one ticket price. So we figured, yeah, we'll just stay, we'll stay and watch the second film. No problem. We're still going to get home by about 10:30. So, you know, it was well within the somewhat curfew that I had with my folks. They were very, very liberal anyway. I mean, I could have probably gotten home at 11 o'clock. This was a Saturday night. So, they were pretty wide open. They trusted me, and I really appreciated them for that, because I got to see some great midnight movies because of that. That are the circumstances surrounding me seeing this movie. This was at the Cardinal Theater in Raleigh, North Carolina. It's still there. It's a big double screen theater. One side of the theater was a big cinemascope theater. You know, it's with the big curved screen, and you know the theater had to have three projectors to show those kind of films. And then the other one was just a standard large screen theater on the other side. This one ran on that one. It wasn't in, this was not in CinemaScope. It was just a standard 1.85 by 1 resolution. So we went to see the Andromeda Strain, and then, you know, there would be like about a 15-minute break, a hiatus, for them to clean up the theater a little bit and then let us all back in to see Silent Running. So, you know, we're coming off the heels of watching Andromeda Strain, which, you know, we were blown away. We loved the movie. In fact, yes, folks, we are going to be talking about Andromeda Strain this season as well. It is definitely on our list of films that we're going to be covering. Staying for Silent Running now here. So I had no idea what the movie was about. We didn't know what to expect. And the movie opens up to the strains of Joan Baez. So we're wondering, you know, and we're seeing plants growing and animals and lizards and things. And then this guy swimming in the water and stuff. And I'm wondering, gee, what kind of science fiction movie is this? We had no idea what the story was behind Silent Running because, again, Universal didn't invest any money in marketing on this film. None whatsoever. They wanted it all word of mouth, like Easy Rider and some of these, and American Graffiti and some of these other films that did really, really well. Now, the way that this film influenced Star Wars, which is sort of fun, is that you're going to see three little drone robots in this film called Huey, Dewey, and Louie. And, of course, they were named after Donald Duck's nephews. And when George Lucas, he knew Douglas Trumbull, all these guys hung together in the same crowd. Bruce Dern knew all these guys as well. A lot of them were from the Corman School, and George Lucas was. I mean, they all did work with Roger Corman at some point, and that's where they learned how to direct and act and all of that. When George Lucas came up with the idea to do Star Wars, he wanted to base one of the characters on Huey, Dewey, and Louie. And he went to Douglas Trumbull and said, look, I've got this movie that I'm doing, and this big science fiction, and it's going to have a robot in there that I'm going to make is very similar to Huey, Dewey, and Louie. Would it be okay? I mean, I want your blessing on that. I don't want you to think I'm just stealing it from you. And Trumbull says, no, sure, go ahead and do that. And that's how we got R2-D2. So anyway, so all these guys knew each other. That was what was so cool about the films that came out during this time period, because all of these indie guys, they all hung out together. They all knew one another. It was just a magnificent collection of people that were getting involved with filmmaking. And, you know, if the studios hadn't been so wanting to make millions and billions of dollars, you know, and exploit this type of situation, you know, we might have seen, you know, even more of these films come down the way. But, you know, money gets in the way of everything. And we're seeing a little bit of a resurgence now with the digital age, because now it costs so much less to make a film and make a high quality film that we're seeing another group of young directors coming out. And this is great time for people who love movies. So anyway, let me get into talking about who you're going to see in Silent Running. It's got a very small cast. In fact, you're basically only four people altogether that you're going to see in the film. You're going to hear one of the characters. And of course, and I want to talk a little bit about the Huey, Dewey, and Louie drones, because they are very interesting as well, the casting behind them. But of course, Bruce Dern, we're talking about Bruce Dern. This is pretty much his film all the way, because the majority of the screen time, we're going to see him. He plays a man by the name of Freeman Lowell. Freeman Lowell is a conservationist, and he's an astronaut. And let me give you the quick thumbnail of the storyline. The storyline is basically the Earth. It's been called post-apocalyptic by some. They never really say if there was a war or anything, or whether it was a problem with ecology or, you know, pollution or whatever. And I thought this was an appropriate movie on the heels of Madeline and I doing Godzilla versus Hedorah, because that was all, you know, had a lot of storyline rooted in pollution and how we were destroying the Earth and things. But bottom line is, the woods, the forests, the plant life, it's all been affected by Earth. There are no more parks anymore. Everything has been built up and around, you know, and so in an effort to try to save this kind of thing, The United States has launched a series of spacecraft, large freighter-type spacecraft. This is well into the future because we have space travel that involves commerce or involves, I would say mining operations and things of that nature. So we've got these large spacecrafts that do act as freighters, in outer space. They are built to house trees and plants and animals, things you would find in wooded areas and in parks and that sort of thing, in these big domed enclosures. And they launch them into outer space to be tended by these astronauts until such time that they can bring them back to Earth and repopulate the planet with all this flora and fauna. So, you're thinking, yeah, this is a wonderful idea by the government to do this, to try to salvage, try to bring this back to correct our wrongs. Because there's many areas now in the United States that are dealing with this where, we're putting everything under asphalt or concrete and we're running out of green space. And so there is a move on to try to save our green space. This is the crux of the movie. These four astronauts on this one ship, the Valley Forge, which have these domes, and they never specifically say how many, but I believe it's 6 domes per ship. The original script called for 22 per ship, but that was just a little too exorbitant. They didn't have enough of a budget. Trumbull couldn't pull that off. So they went with 6 on each ship. And you've got many of these ships. You don't see too many of them, but you're just aware of they're talking. They talk to other ships during the film. So, there's a whole bunch of these out there. And you've got Lowell, who's dedicated to this. He's got the conservationist pledge hanging in his bedroom, in his quarters. He is sort of the hippie guy. Walks around in long robes, and he communes with all the animals in the domes. He swims in the little pools and streams that they have manufactured there for the forest. He eats food that he grows there while the other three are eating the synthetically produced food from some kind of machine that makes this stuff that sustains them. And they have a long conversation about this. This is real food that I'm eating. Because they're always kidding him about, Lowell, he's always, boy, he's out there, growing this stuff. Your food comes from dirt, so it's real food. He said, yeah, it is real food. It's a perfect character, I think, for Bruce Stern. Originally, they had written the character as an older character, but it worked better with Dern. I really can't see it working any other way because Bruce Stern has established his career as playing fringe actors. I mean, fringe characters. Not always bad guys, but this is one where he's sort of a good guy and a bad guy together. And I'll explain that when we get into the storyline a little bit. By the way, folks, I will spoil everything about this movie. And the thing about this movie is, and again, I'm going to be very loving towards this film because I think it's an absolutely brilliant film. I do. I am in the minority when it comes to that. A lot of people do not like this movie. The critics did not care for it. A lot of the big critics did not like it at all. This is one of the other few times where I've agreed with Roger Ebert. Roger Ebert really liked this movie as well. It's funny because when he had his show years ago, I very rarely did we agree with one another. But this is one time again that I agree with Roger Ebert. I think this film is really, really well made, and I think even spoiled, it's worth a look at the craftsmanship and the artistry. And I'm just absolutely stunned at how well Douglas Trumbull did in his first effort out there. For the little bit of money that he had and what he did with it and the performances he got, he did a great job. And this is just an incredible performance by Bruce Stern. I think it's one of his best performances. Those of us, we knew Bruce Stern. A lot of us knew him from The Outer Limits. And one of the best episodes of The Outer Limits, The Xanti Misfits. But we'd seen him in some of the other independent films he had done with Corman and others, and he'd made quite a name for himself on television. So he was a recognizable character. And one of the bad knocks he got on himself during his career, this happened in a film he did 8 years after this one came out, in The Cowboys, you remember the John Wayne film, he's one of the few people that ever killed John Wayne on screen, character to character. And there were people that held that against him. He said, you know, he received death threats from fans because he killed John Wayne. He said that the producers always considered him a villain after that. They never saw him as anything else other than a villain because he's the guy that killed John Wayne on screen. Bad knock because he's too good of an actor to have put up with that. And he's still with us. He is still going with us strong. I mean, he's still acting. So it's just he's always been one of my favorite character actors and really enjoy watching him work. And he, you know, a lot of people thought maybe he took it a little too extreme in this character, but I think he's committed to conserving and to, you know, the beauty of nature that was being destroyed, that had been destroyed on Earth. And he was on a mission, you know, what he considered almost a sacred mission to help save this stuff so he could come back. Someday they would bring them all back and then they would, you know, they would replant all of this stuff, you know, and have parks and forests and stuff. And he's got a great soliloquy when he's talking to the other three guys about a picture that he has on his wall of a little girl. And he says, this little girl will never know. We'll never know the beauty of holding a leaf in her hand, you know, or of laying down in the grass or a blue sky. So in all of this, you know, these little soliloquies and these little comments that he makes at the very beginning of the film, we get the idea that, yeah, maybe there aren't even blue skies anymore. Everything's all smoggy and gray. So it sounds like not a very, very good world. And then he talks about how everybody's the same. The temperature's always the same. It's always 75 degrees no matter where you go. Everybody dresses the same. They all look the same. They all do the same. Again, the guys are arguing, yeah, but I mean, you know, everybody's got a job and all that. He goes, yeah, that's what you always argue. It's always about that. Everybody's got a job. Well, there's more to the world than just having a job, you know. So he has established it. And again, when we saw it in 72, we said, yeah, he's sort of a hippie-type character. You know, a futuristic type hippie-type. He's holding on to the, you know, to the old ideas. So he becomes very sympathetic, I think, in the very beginning of the film. Very sympathetic. Now, the other people you're going to see in the film, the three guys that play the other astronauts, Cliff Potts, Ron Rifkin, and Jesse Vint, all of them very capable veteran actors. Ron Rifkin, I guess a lot of folks are going to remember, he did a ton of stuff, over 124 credits, but a lot of them are going to remember him as the bad guy on Alias. He gets confused a lot for Joel Grey because, and it's interesting, he and Joel Grey do have a connection. Not only do they look very similar to one another, they both appeared in Cabaret. Of course, Joel Grey in the original Cabaret. And then when Cabaret had a resurgence on Broadway, Ron Rifkin played the same character and won a Tony Award for his participation in that version of Cabaret. So on a episode of Alias, if you're a fan of the show Alias, you might remember when Joel Grey was a guest star on there playing a guy who thought he was the bad guy character that Ron Rifkin played on Alias. He's also been in movies like Sum of All Fears, L.A. Confidential, Boiler Room, and others. I mean, just a quality actor in this. The acting in all of this is really good. Cliff Potts may be the least experienced actor of all the guys in this, but he had nearly 70 credits, acted right up until 2016. And then Jesse Vint, who I remember seeing in Macon County Line. I think that was the first time I remember he and his brother both starred in that, along with Max Baer Jr. and others. And that became a really big cult film. He hit Hollywood, or I should say he hit L.A., and started acting, the story goes, like a week later. You know, he was in Chinatown, Little Big Man, Forbidden World. I mean, unbelievable. He is definitely the most veteran actor, other than Bruce Dern, of those guys. He's had up to 70 credits in films and TV and just in a variety of things. And again, All of these guys are solid, solid actors. So they've got it, and they have a good chemistry with one another, which really makes this film work. Now, these three are only seen probably in about the first third of the film. And they're sort of the reckless, irresponsible guys, you know, where you've got Bruce Dern, who is the total commitment to this mission. And these guys are just, they were just out in outer space, you know, and we're getting bored and we don't have anything to do. They have these little ATVs. They race around the spaceship, you know, tearing up things and all of that sort of thing. But they all get along. They have to. I mean, because they don't know when they're going back home. So, I mean, but there's this, you know, they rag on Lowell quite a bit, you know, because he is so different and he's so serious, you know, and he's the serious guy in the bunch. And that's the guy you usually pick on. We were like that growing up too. We all were. That's what we got here. But, you know, they enjoy playing poker together and Lowell is the best poker player amongst them. They keep saying, you know, Lowell, you know, what are you going to do when they call us home or whatever? And he says, "Hey, you know, I'm going to take over the Parks and Recreation Department, or whatever, you know, the Department of Parks and Recreation for the government or whatever. I'm the guy that's going to oversee all of this." He said, "Who else? Who else knows these plants and animals and things better than me? I'm the perfect choice." And they've got a big message coming in. They know it's coming in. Now, right now, the Valley Forge is somewhere out around Saturn. That's where they're at the moment. It takes a few minutes for messages to get out there to them, but they're expecting this big message. And he says, "I got it. I got a good feeling about this. I think this is they're calling us back. I think it's going to be time. You know, they're going to put the next plan into motion where they plan all this, and I'm going to be ready to oversee it all because I'm going to be the guy. I'm going to be there." Yeah. Well, it doesn't turn out to work that way. Because when the government calls them, they said, "Okay, now we've decided we're scrapping the project." This is so typical of the government. And again, you know, it works itself into this story. 1971, you got a lot of mistrust in the government. We're still in the Vietnam War. This is the Nixon years. A lot of people didn't trust Nixon for good reason. Just a lot of bad things going on. Of course, this is right around Watergate and all of that. So the government said, "Yep, you're just going to jettison all of these domes with all the force on them and blow them up." They have a nuclear device built into them. You know, just jettison them away from the spacecraft, blow them up, and then head back to Earth, and they're going to become freighters again. Just get rid of it all. They've been out there for 8 years doing this. Maybe it was an administration change, a new president or something. Who knows? I think that maybe the fact that they picked 8 years might not have been an accident. You know, that's the first thing I thought of was, wow, we had an election, and a new guy came in who says, "We're not going to spend this money anymore. Get rid of it all." Yeah, just trash all of this stuff. Does that sound familiar? Yeah, I think we have seen that before in the history of this country. We're all watching this thinking, that's so typical. Why? These were self-sustaining freighters? Oh, well. Anyway, Lowell is beside himself. He doesn't know what he's going to do. He can't believe it. They're going to destroy all of this and then just go back home. And he lives for this. Now, I want to mention one more thing before I go further on with the storyline, and that is our little guys, Huey, Dewey, and Louie. Trumbull casts three multi-amputees to suit up as these little guys because they actually walk around and stuff like that. And Mark Pearson's, Cheryl Sparks, and Larry Wisenhunt were the people portraying Louie, Dewey, and Huey. Now, during the show, one of the drones gets killed. Well, I should say it gets destroyed, and I will tell you about that when we get into the storyline. So you basically just have Huey and Dewey that are left throughout the remainder of the film. But I just thought this was fascinating, that they found these folks that were able to do this. And they do a great job because you fall in love with these characters. And I can see where the inspiration that George Lucas got from these. Guys, because think about how we feel nowadays about R2-D2. We think of him as an actual actor. You know, we don't even, you know, a lot of people don't even know who the actor is inside of R2-D2. But they think of R2-D2 as a character, and you will with Dewey and Huey. I mean, they become real. That is a credit not only to the people inside the suit, but it's a credit to the way Trumbull directs this, because you really are sympathetic for these guys. And you're feeling sympathetic right now in this story, where we left off on the story here, to Freeman Lowell, because they're going to blow up everything he believes in, everything he loves. You know, you see the rabbits and the birds and all this, you know, and I got to admit, I'm like a little shocked watching this movie for the first time, thinking, I can't believe they're going to get rid of all this. Just coldly blow it all up. And of course, the next visual scenes in the movie are powerful because, you know, the other three guys are like, hey, we're going home. Hey, we're going home. All right. Hey, Lowell, we're going home, you know, and you could tell it is such a subtle performance by Bruce Dern. And he's so good at doing it. I mean, he can play a totally manic bad guy. And he has a chance to do that a little bit here. But right now, he's just tortured. You can see it. While these guys, they're going from dome to dome, and they're putting in the little arming devices, and then they're ejecting the dome, and boom, and you've got these big vibrations and the ship shakes, once the dome is safe enough away where they can nuke it and blow it up. And every time you hear one of these or feel one of these explosions, see the big flash, it just, you could see it cut more of his heart out until he snaps. He's in the last dome. And one of the guys comes in there with his little briefcase. It's got the little arming devices, and they get into a fight. And the fight gets pretty ugly. And Lowell kills him. And then he realizes what he's done. And at that point, he knows there's no return. And he goes into the control room. And while the other two guys are in another dome, just finishing up in there, he launches it and blows it up with them in it. And then he's got to decide, what am I going to do? And of course, there's other ships around him. One, the Berkshire, which I especially liked because my mother grew up in the Berkshire Mountains. And we used to spend a lot of our summers in the Berkshire Mountains on my grandfather's farm. It was one of the best times of my life. So when I heard, oh, Berkshire, yeah, I bet you this guy, and as it turns out, Douglas Trumbull lives in the Berkshire Mountains. He lives in that area of Massachusetts. Beautiful. I hard to describe. You know, I feel like, as a person, I've been very, very fortunate. One, I could spend my summers on my grandfather's farm, which I can't even begin to describe to you the view that his farm has. I know my family know what I'm talking about. It's like, it's right out of Norman Rockwell. Amazing. And then when I moved to Georgia, and my folks and I, we all went in on some property down there. A lot of folks that know me, who know where my old house was, can tell you the view that I used to have out of my front porch, very much the same. Just amazing. Yeah, so I feel very lucky that I've had that in my life. Not two different places that I could experience that. Not to take away from where I'm living now, but it's just like, boy, it was just nothing like it. And so when I saw Berkshires, I thought, yeah, because the guys with me didn't know what the Berkshires, you know, didn't know the reference to the Berkshires, didn't realize it was a mountain range of Massachusetts. So here we've got Lowell. What's he going to do? The Berkshire's coming on there, the captain. He's really the only other person, that I would say actor, that you will hear. And he's played by Joseph Campanella. Yeah, one of the most veteran television and movie actors around. I mean, he was in virtually everything I saw on TV growing up. Just an incredible actor, just incredibly versatile actor for several decades. You know, the Berkshire captain's going, hey, what's going on here? there's one other voice you're going to hear, and that's Roy Engel as well, who plays, actually, he's named. He's a guy named Anderson, who's the radio guy for the Berkshire. They can't figure out what's going on, and of course, Lowell said, yeah, we're having a problem, we're good. And then he finally, he develops, a scheme. Where he says, well, we're having a problem. Yeah, we can't launch the final dome. I think the other one launched accidentally. I believe a couple of the guys were in there. Oh my God, it's horrible and all that. And makes it sound like that he can't control the ship. Then he fires the boosters, and they're going, "What are you doing? You're moving." And he goes, "I can't stop it. I can't get to the control panel. The damage is too great." And he stages a situation where they think that he's lost. You know, even for a second, there's a brief conversation with this guy Anderson who says, you know, you know, might be thinking about ending it all. And he goes, no, I could never do suicide. I never, that's just not in my nature, which would come back as an irony later on in the movie. Yeah, I'm giving that away. He ends up doing something called a Saturn maneuver. It's also called shooting the rapids in outer space, where he's going to shoot across the rings of Saturn, and it covers his escape so that they can't see him when he leaves, and they would never be able to track him, so to speak. And he says, you know, the guy says, well, you know, we'll try to send, maybe we'll send a mission out after you, you know, or a rescue mission, whatever. He says, what's the point? Don't do it. You know, it's no use. So he's trying to cover his tracks any way he can. Now, the history behind the effects where they're shooting the rapids in this movie, it's pretty interesting. This is something that Stanley Kubrick wanted to do in 2001. Originally in the movie, he wanted the final sort of psychedelic sequence with Dave Bowman in that movie took place around Jupiter. Well, originally he wanted it, Kubrick wanted it around Saturn, but they couldn't quite work out the technology needed to make that effect work. But after the movie, Trumbull was able to finish that sequence or that what it would take to make that special effect. And so he uses it in this movie. So there's a connection between 2001 as well, in addition to just the fact that Trumbull worked on both films. So he does that and he shoots out into deep space, never to be seen again. And now during the, this is where we lose Louis. Louis is out working on the exterior of the ship. The other two drones are headed back in, and Lowell's on there to Louis, say, go, why aren't you following the other two? You've got to go in. You got to go in during, you know, and Louis is pulled off the ship and disappears, killed. Because you think of these guys as people, you really do. We later find out that what happened was that Louis got a little careless and he got his foot stuck on one of the beams out on the exterior, and he couldn't get loose. He couldn't get free, and it just pulled him away. They find his foot later on. So Lowell, in what sort of a fun sequence, he reprograms Huey and Dewey to obey all of his commands and to do more than just take care of the domes in the forest. He teaches them how to play poker. That's sort of a fun sequence, especially when one of them wins one of the games. He gets a kick out of that. And of course, we do see Lowell racing around like the other guys did. They're doing all kinds of stuff. He's teaching the two of them how to plant trees. And you know, they screw that up and he has to teach them. But there's some little bit of humor built into the loneliness that is going along with this, but he does have some companionship. Well, during one sequence, something screws up where Lowell has told to stay in the dome. There's a problem. He's gonna jump in the ATV and meet him in there. And Huey doesn't do it. He comes walking out into one of the hallways, and he's hit by the ATV and damaged severely. Now, Lowell is able to get him functional again, but he's never right after that. I do want to mention one of the coolest things about where they shot this. The USS Valley Forge was an aircraft carrier that was prevalent in the Korean War, and it's been decommissioned, and it was parked in Long Beach. And they used the ship for their interior scenes for the spacecraft. They refitted it a little bit and repainted it and stuff, and they used the command center and some of the storage bays and things, and it really looks great. And then after that, then they scrapped it after this movie was made. The modeling, I should say, for the exterior of the ship for this film was 26 feet long, and this is one thing. But if there's any downer about this movie in my book, was that they saved the model for a while. They put it into storage. But after a while, you know the story. I'm sure you know the story about this. It's happened so many times, the films made back then, that it got too expensive to store it, so they took it apart and threw it away. There are pieces of it still around. One of the domes is in a museum, in a movie museum, and there's some larger sections of the ship survived and are in some private collections. But you know, it's just sad how we don't have any of that stuff anymore. Yeah, the studios were so quick to throw this stuff away. One of the ingenious things that Douglas Trumbull did, because of the low bit of money that he had to work with this, with the effects, was he brought in a lot of school kids who were studying model making and special effects to make all the models. And they did a heck of a job. They really did. It's really, really outstanding work. The special effects in this movie are just terrific. Now, you have to suspend disbelief a little bit on the science, because during the explosions, you hear them, which, you know, in space, there's no sound. You would feel vibrations, but you wouldn't hear the explosions. But for dramatic effect, you put that in there. We all pretty much put up with that. I mean, even nowadays in sci-fis, because it's just, you know, it's just a good, it's good storytelling. It's just a good dramatic effect. So you got Lowell now, and now he's down to one very workable robot. You know, and one that's, he can walk around and stuff, but he really can't do things that he could do before, because Lowell just didn't have what he needed to totally fix him from the accident. And as it turns out, not too long after this, the radio starts cracking. There's somebody out there. And you hear, it's the Berkshire. And they have found them. We found you. We found you, Lowell. And we'll be there in about 6 hours. We're going to be there. We'll board your ship. And we're going to get you, we're going to take you home. Well, Lowell knows that they're going to find out the truth, that there was no accident, and that he basically murdered the other three, and he has no choice. And he knows that they're going to destroy the forest. And so he tells Dewey, it's a poignant part of the movie. A great, I think just a marvelous ending to this movie. Tells Dewey, he says, you know everything you need to know to take care of the forest. All you have to do from here on out is take care of the forest. And he launches the forest. He jettisons the forest. Now, he didn't blow it up. He just lets it go. And then he blows up the ship. Now, one other side story that happened in this movie that is really poignant is that after Lowell gets into deep space, the forest starts dying. And he can't figure out why. And this caught some criticism from some of the critics, because there's no sunlight. He's out beyond where the sun can get sunlight. You know, it's like, he's a conservationist. When he realized, well, yeah, I mean, he probably knew that sunlight, he does, it did curse him. He goes, oh my God, it's sunshine. It occurs to him when the Berkshire shows up. And so he has to race to get up these sun lamps. These self-sustaining sun lamps before he launches the dome, so that now it can go anywhere in outer space, and the forest will be all right. And they've got Dewey taking care of it. But yeah, the story ends in a big bang. And Lowell, now, the man who told the Berkshire captain, oh no, I'm not one for suicide. That's something I probably would never do. It's his only way out. And he goes out with what he thinks is, you know, basically the dignity of knowing that he saved a forest from the planet Earth that these guys were just going to so willfully destroy. Now, I think that a lot of the critics didn't like this movie because it's a tour de force. It's a character study. It's a total character study for this character, Freeman Lowell. It's a thinking man's film. It's not a lot of action. And that may have been what turned them off, because they wanted action. They wanted, you know, entertainment, more entertainment, not thought-provoking type stuff. But these were the kind of movies that came out in the early 70s. And these were the kind of movies that guys like me and my age, we loved, because they challenged us. They made us think. Even movies like Godzilla versus Hedorah, they made us think about conservation and what we're doing to the planet and things. And this one was quite a... I think quite a commentary on how the government works and what they think is important and not important, and how things can be an important issue one day and 8 years later not be so important anymore. Yeah, we see that all the time. And the storytelling and the artistry that Trumbull uses to make this film is just, it's brilliant. And it's a shame that he never got a chance to do more as a director. He would do one other film, one other science fiction after this called Brainstorm, which I actually like. It was Natalie Wood's last film. They shot it in Durham, North Carolina when I was living up there. And, you know, she and Christopher Walken were the stars. And I liked the movie a lot. But Louise Fletcher was also in it. But that's the only other film that he would, big film that he would direct. He never really got a chance to do it because this film tanked at the box office. It did not do well. And it's made a little money and it's developed a cult following since then. And it, you know, for those of you that may have never seen this film, I mean, it has been released. It was released on Betamax and then VHS, several versions of VHS, then DVD. And it's a couple of different versions of Blu-ray. A newer version on Blu-ray was released back in 2020. So, I mean, there's all kinds of versions out there. It's available streaming as well. I think it's like $3 on Amazon Prime. And that's the restored version. It's beautiful. It's restored to, you know, to pristine condition. And it's 1.85x1 resolution. It's a beautiful film, folks. And I think it's one of the more engaging films I had seen growing up. And it's just one of those films that also, you know, helped me develop my love for character studies. Because from early age, I loved those kind of movies. And if you are into character studies, even if you're not into character studies, but if you are, definitely you need to see this film if you've not seen it. And if you aren't, give it a shot. Because it's a well-spent hour and a half. It really is. I give it a huge thumbs up. It is one of my favorite science fiction films and just one of my favorite cult films. And I'm glad it's developed the positive following that it has developed. And, you know, Douglas Trumbull, you did a great job. I think you did a magnificent job on this. Incredible for your first effort out as a director. Silent Running from 1972. Hey, folks, we'll be back with you again next week with an all-new episode of Monster Attack. Thanks again for your support. We have really appreciated all the support you've shown us. You still have time to cast a ballot for the Rondo Hatton Awards. We have been nominated for Best Horror Podcast for 2021. And if you enjoy the show, we appreciate your support. Look on the fan page and also on my personal page. You can also find it on Classic Movie Monsters on that page as well, how to vote for the Rondo Hatton Awards. It's very easy. You just go and copy and paste into an email and you'll have the directions where to send the email. We would greatly appreciate your vote if you think we're worthy of it. Thanks again, folks. Have a great week, and we'll see you next Monday.
Okay, promo for the Flopcast. Let's go.
First, I need an adjective.
Naked.
Need a noun.
Wombat.
Place.
Woonsocket, Rhode Island.
Number.
251.
Okay then, the Flopcast is a naked podcast about cartoons, music, comics, movies, and wombats. Find us on the ESO Network and flopcast.net. Go ahead and listen to it in Woonsocket, Rhode Island, 251 times.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.